Good morning, John.
Good morning, Scott.
Do you have any tobacco?
I don't. I'm sorry.
That's okay. This is Popcorn Eschaton, a show on the Zebras in America channel where I, Scott Thurow, and John Arminio talk about film with a leftist and religious lens and talk about films from the lens of looking at where spirituality, religion, economics, politics, and leftism exist, intersect, and sometimes the films explicitly have all of this, sometimes these films implicitly all have all of this, and then we talk about it for about 45 minutes to an hour. John, for this week's episode, you presented two very interesting movies. Can you tell me about the documentary that you recommended?
Yeah, I've been just thinking about trying to get some Native American voices on the podcast. And, you know, there's been a ton of Native American representation in film, obviously. But most of that, the vast majority of it, has been from white writers and directors, and, you know, even if that's done with the best of intentions, I think that's, like, a problem. And, you know, one of the most prominent, or one of the only prominent indigenous creators in the film industry in the U.S. is Sterling Harjo, who was really the creative force behind this show Reservation Dogs. Which is fantastic. And so I was just looking at his filmography, and he had several films before that series premiered. And one of them was the documentary Love and Fury. And it's about several Native American artists sort of struggling to put out their art in a world that has a vast amount of preconceptions about them. So they're trying to find their own voice, trying to, you know, do their art without being, you know, subjected to prejudice in a world where it's difficult to make art, period. And so it takes a really interesting look at several musicians, some performance artists, some visual artists, tackles like differences in artistic output from generation to generation, how geography affects their art, how like movement affects their art, and how dealing with native and non-native communities affects art. So it's real interesting interesting look. And if you are a careful Reservation Dogs viewer, you'll notice that some t-shirts from the bands in the documentary show up every once in a while. So particularly the band Weed Rat shows up on several cast members.
Yeah, so I actually have not yet seen Reservation Dogs, although I've heard that it's one of the great shows of the recent 10 years, and it's something that I look forward to watching, though I'm, you know, familiar with Sterling and that he's really on the vanguard of celebrating art of indigenous Native American cultures. So I thought that he did a really beautiful job in this movie, and he did a bunch of interesting tricks, and not tricks but approaches, that I thought were obviously deliberate, right? So if I'm correct, he doesn't give you the names of anybody.
No, he does not.
Which is, like, really, really very interesting, and a very interesting choice. And I read an interview that, not an interview, sorry, I read a review because I was like really trying to unpack this movie because I was like, oh, this really is different. And they called the movie frustratingly shapeless. And I was like, oh, you're so wrong. The shapelessness of it is what makes it so good. The fact that it goes in and out of these stories is the profound nature. And I think that's a very limited Western, which is funny to say Western when I mean like Western white viewing of storytelling, that of linear, you know what I mean?
Yes.
So the things that people found frustrating, the in and out of the stories of the different artists and the in and out of not saying the names of the artists, was, I thought, a very thoughtful method of telling the story. And how part of me wishes that it was a docuseries because I just loved all the art, but I also think a good documentary or a good nonfiction book or a good piece of presentation invites you to do more work afterwards. So I plan on finding some of this music. I plan on looking into the art. I plan on continuing my journey of downloading, literally and figuratively, this art. Mm-hmm. You were going to say something?
Yeah, you know, just this one woman. If you do the millennial / Gen Z thing of turning on subtitles, you do get the speakers' names. But that's the only way to find them out. Towards the end, this one woman, I believe her name was Emily, she's a performance artist, and she starts talking about her experience at her grandmother's restaurant or bar. The anglicized name of it would be the Thank You Bar. And it is like this non-linear just avalanche of emotions of her experiences there as a child, from like the smell of the food and the community and the friends she made there, to the fact that it was the place of a sexual assault. And I think that is like a microcosm of what this documentary does, is that like art and life and the struggle to express ourselves and to find our own voice, like, it is sort of like shapeless. It's not linear. It's not something you can grab a hold of. So I admire that Harjo was, you know, willing and able to sort of present these moments in time in these artists' life without feeling like he had to create a beginning and an end point with all of their struggles, because there's certain artists who clearly have it together and have a artistic philosophy and are like incredibly inspirational, and then there are other artists that are really struggling both with their art and, you know, with addiction or disability or with just straight up prejudice.
Yeah, and the thing is, like, to discuss the Native American experience, which is hardly monolithic,
yep,
is to discuss the first sin of America, which is the expulsion and genocide of a large percentage of the Native American population and the continued oppression of Native American population and the reservation system and the missionaries and the what do you call it, the schools,
the Native American schools. Yeah, actually, that's one of the key reasons why I wanted to do this, because I live in Carlisle, Pennsylvania. The flagship Native American school is the Carlisle Indian School, whose mantra was, you know, kill the Indian to save the man. And so they forcibly shipped hundreds of Native American children to Carlisle, Pennsylvania to, like, educate them in whiteness, I guess. And to my school district's credit, in middle school, everybody took a field trip to that school, which is now a military base, because the school was founded on a military base anyway. And, like, we toured the graveyard of all the kids that died there. So it's, like, it was a part of my growing up, a part of the growing up of everyone in Carlisle, Pennsylvania, that this sort of, like, microcosm of the genocide of Native Americans, that we were, you know, forced to learn about it. And I think that's good. But I think for most of America, like, they're able to put America's foundational sin out of sight, out of mind. And one of the things that I think about for that is, like, I like a lot the HBO Watchmen show. And, you know, it takes place in Oklahoma, and part of that is because the impetus of much of the storytelling is the, like, Tulsa race massacre of Black Wall Street in 1921. And so that's where it takes place. But for the series that is sort of like a reckoning of America's history of racism that takes place in Oklahoma, like, no one ever says the words Native American. Like, it's not in the show's purview. And Oklahoma is the location of the largest reservation in America. It's where the Trail of Tears ended.
Mm-hmm. And it's where our second movie we will discuss as well.
Yeah. So even if in a show that's about racism that I think is very well intentioned in those topics, it just doesn't even address, you know, the genocide of Native Americans.
Yeah, so, I mean, I have some issues with the show Watchmen, mm-hmm. and what I will say is, I thought that they were trying to do something cool of how do you create a story about Watchmen that isn't Zack Snyder's way too close translation, aside from a very weird ending and being very Zack Snyder-y. How do you tell? So Watchmen, and this is a side story, but I think Alan Moore is really interesting because of his politics and his spirituality, and like, I think he's an anarchist. I mean, a lot of his stories are just about anarchy and the problem of politics, and he's one of the greatest storytellers of comics, and I'd say on the Mount Rushmore, he's up there. Even though there are people that do the things that he does that I like a little more, mm-hmm. but that's besides the point. Watchmen, when it came out, was one of the most important comic books of its time. But now that it created the trope of, oh, what if, like, superheroes were messed up? I don't know that it's as good as it was when it came out now, and that there aren't stories that tackle that story better. So Watchmen is a problematic microcosm because when Damon Lindelof, white dude, creator of Lost, who there's a lot of stuff that suggests not the coolest dude, was tasked with making Watchmen a show, he decided to make it a sequel to the comic book and did some really cool things and told some cool stories, but made a lot of decisions that frustrated me. And a lot of decisions that I think would have been better made if perhaps the people making the film weren't Damon Lindelof and had more diversity. And it comes to this other microcosm and macrocosm where we don't want to discuss what happened to Native Americans. We don't want to discuss slavery. There's a large part of America that wants to not talk about the things that have happened and are getting successful, banning books, banning topics, creating boogeymen. Critical race theory which isn't taught in high schools or college, or really most, it is taught in some colleges, but it's not taught in elementary schools. The books that have become the boogeymans of book bannings are not in any children's libraries, you know, and the new word is, you know, DEI, which they're trying to use as a new way to not say racist tropes. And this is all a way to minimize and try to not talk about all this terrible stuff that have happened in the two original sins of America, which is what happened to the Native Americans and slavery. And you have to be able to talk about these things to talk about the future of our soul. And I'm so glad that we decided to discuss two films by the same director, but decided to talk about Native American stories before talking about like Killers of the Flower Moon, right? Because we've talked about Martin Scorsese a lot, and I'm sure we will talk about Killers of the Flower Moon at some point, because we talk about Westerns, we talk about epics, we talk about Martin Scorsese, and we talk about religion and politics, so I think it's ripe for it, and I heard Martin Scorsese did a very good job, but again, I heard there were limitations, even though he tried very hard. And I think I don't think that people need to be of the population to tell a story, but it certainly helps because the stories that are the way that these two movies that we talked about were presented in a point of view that I've not seen before, which leads me to believe that that has to do with the point of views of how the director was raised. And again, to talk about the non-linearity and the poeticism and the looseness, right, of all of this.
and you know, that topic is addressed in Love and Fury in one really pointed way. They're talking to a traditional Native American carver in Alaska, and you know, he says, oh, you know, I met a white carver the other day, and so, you know, somebody doing traditional Native American art on like the bones of like aquatic animals, so, you know, whale and seal. And, you know, he sort of confronted the white guy about this, and the white guy says, well, art is for everybody all the time. And if you were to just, like, say, John, is art for everybody all the time? I would say, well, yes. But when presented with this specific example of a white guy doing this traditional Native American art that was outlawed, as the Native American artist elucidates, that was taken away from his people by white people for generations, and now he and his generation are struggling to get it back to save you know, what their ancestors lost, you can certainly understand why it maybe is not a great idea for this white guy to be doing this art, and why the Native American version of that art is going to be very different and special when compared to the white version of that art.
And it also creates these complications. You know, one of my favorite bands is the Flaming Lips. Mm-hmm. Or let me rephrase. The Flaming Lips made four albums from 1998 to 2003 that are some of the most important albums of my life. And the music before and after that, I'm not as much attached to, but they're from Oklahoma. And for some time, the lead singer was Wayne Coyne, was wearing Native American headdress, and people were like, hey, don't do that, bro. And he really was pushed back on it, and it was very frustrating. And there's been this pushback of appropriating culture and where it's appropriate, where it's not. It's certainly not my place to say, but I'd say that headdresses are definitely something that are complicated. I know that the tradition of the Native, that the New Orleans has a tradition of I'm going to say Native American outfits that are done by black cultures in New Orleans, but you can look into it. I guess for context, it's like New Orleans Indians. So if you look into it, a lot of Native Americans have been like, nah, it's cool. This is cool. Like, yep. we know that there's no disrespect in there, but it's just very complicated and not my place to make the statements. And when confronted, just like one of the things of restoration and forgiveness, and two things that I think are very important in the religious and political aspect of the things that we try to talk about is this show, is accountability, restoration, and openness and dialogue. So when and how we react, and in this theory of redemption. So when someone like Elizabeth Warren or Johnny Depp, who have claimed Native ancestry for a long time, when it's shown that they really don't, they could just be like, I was told something growing up and I was wrong. But yeah. So I'm going to try to do right moving forward instead of still fighting for it, you know, because Johnny Depp for a long time was like, I have Native American heritage, so I can play Tonto, you know, mm-hmm. in the, why am I drawing a blank?
Lone Ranger movie.
The Lone Ranger movie, which is a fucking mess. That movie is a fucking mess, and I think it's very interesting, but because of the nature of it, I'm not going to recommend you watch it unless you want to, you know, stream it without giving Disney any money. But it's like weird and plays to the problems of like wearing cultures that aren't part of your culture, which is something that we will discuss one day when we discuss the Wachowski sisters' Cloud Atlas, which is a movie that is super problematic and a movie that I love. So, but I digress. Before we move on to the next movie, mm-hmm. I just want to say something about linearity in many, not all, because again, like, we acknowledge that we're just white dudes talking about Native American cinema.
Yep.
But so to talk about like linearity, we talk. I'm assuming you're familiar with Maslow's hierarchy of needs.
Yes.
So like, you need to be safe, you need to have food, you want to be belong, you want to have self-esteem, you want to understand, and then you want to actualize and understand yourself. And it's like a linear thing. Now, something that is not well known by many people is that Maslow spent a lot of time with indigenous people, and it's very possible and very probable that he developed this idea from the Blackfoot people that he worked with, which they have really tried to not downplay, because there's a First Nation perspective that is non-linear and an expansive concept where of this triangle, or you could say, I guess, like a TP or something like that. And if that's a term I shouldn't use, I apologize. Call me in, and for now, you can email zebraspod@gmail.com. I will answer any questions. And that's self-actualization, community actualization, and cultural perpetuity. And this is like a non-linear, continuous idea. So I think it, and while the film isn't a Blackfoot film, I think you just see that there's less of a straight line narrative throughout the film. And it's on Netflix. The art is incredible. I was deeply moved. And there's a part where one of the main characters, who's just like super charming, is like, I choose optimism in spite of all the pain, and I turn fury into love,
Yeah,
and which floored the shit out of me.
I have that bolded in my notes because if you didn't get to say it, I was gonna say it. So yeah, I'm glad you quoted him. He was extraordinary for sure. Another thing he says is look, he's sort of like at a meeting of Native American artists, and he's looking around. This is generation and generation after hard to perish faces. And just like, Jesus, like he's, it was a very inspirational moment that you're talking about, Scott.
Yeah, so before we move on to the next movie, yeah, what did you think about this movie? Have you checked out any of the music? And what are some of your finishing thoughts?
I think my favorite band from the documentary was a Black Belt Eagle Scout. They rocked. And I was also, I was charmed by like the father and daughter artist pairing. That was a really interesting, fun conversation. Like, just hey, you can do native art without like having a horse in it. Like, just being able to joke around about these topics. So this has very few logs on Letterboxd. So go and watch it.
Yeah, both of these movies like barely have a lot written on them, so I recommend taking a look. And I want to give away as little as possible. But yeah, like finding information, not so easy.
Yeah,
Not.
that's why I picked Sterling Harjo as a filmmaker, because most of the directors on Reservation Dogs are people who have directed movies, but they're movies that have like zero distribution, and so I have no idea if they're good or not. Whereas at least with Sterling Harjo, I'm like, okay, I know this is a talented filmmaker. So if I dive in with two movies that I've never seen before, I have a high probability that they'll be worth talking about.
Yes, so let's, without further ado, talk about this next movie, which was I have lots of thoughts about, and I was left confused, and that's okay.
Yes, so Miko is about a Native American man who's released from prison after 19 years for killing his cousin. And you get the circumstances of that piecemeal throughout the film. But, because he committed this, basically fratricide, because him and his cousin lived as brothers with with their grandmother. His family doesn't want anything to do with him, so he's homeless, and he has to depend on the unhoused community in Tulsa to survive, as well as the kindness of several like people that he encounters on a day-to-day basis. But one of the members of this community is a real predator, and he sort of becomes convinced that this guy Bill, played by Zan McLaren, who if you've watched Dark Winds or Reservation Dogs, you recognize him. He's fantastic. Miko becomes convinced that Bill is a witch who's sort of draining the lifeblood of him and his friends, and they're sort of on a collision course for conflict. But it's a real sort of like on the ground look at what it's like to be unhoused as a Native American, and the demographics bear out that the two communities with the highest percentage of unhoused people are Native American and Native Hawaiian. If you separate out those two groups, but if you combine them, it's Native Hawaiian and then African Americans. Brief clarification, because I want to get this right. I meant to say that the two ethnic groups who have the highest percentage of unhoused are Native American and African American, and if you separate out Native American and Native Hawaiian into separate ethnic groups, which some studies do, those are the two groups with the highest percentage of unhoused in their communities. So, thank you.
And yeah, this movie just haunted me because it had like this main storyline of how difficult it is to reintegrate out of prison and how difficult it is to be unhoused and to be unhoused and having been in prison and being part of a native community and one community not wanting to take you in and then one community being open to take you in. And so that's just one story. And if it was just that story a bit, this is a beautiful movie. It's like similar to, it's mostly delicate. It's slow. It's lyrical. It is also relentless, and it deals with prison culture very loosely, and folk tales, and the American dream, and again, redemption of the soul. And is this person redeemable? I mean, he spent a long time in prison, and you could argue you own like that long time, that amount is usually reserved for certain crimes. But then if you look at intersectionality, that certain populations are dealt with a much harder hand than other populations in this country. So, and then there's this sort of side story introduced of is this other dude a witch? And what culminates? And would you like to talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, So this guy Bill, he's a drug dealer, and he sort of, it seems like he's purposefully getting addicts to be in his debt just so he can beat the shit out of them. Like, he's a real sadistic manipulator of people. He's constantly lying. He seems to take great pleasure in causing other people pain. And so, in a real literal way, he is feeding off the misery of people who are already in crisis. And you know, like, there's the film sort of like goes back and forth with some like meditative flashbacks about the philosophy of witches that Miko's grandmother gave to him. Like, you got to kill that darkness. It's the only way to make room in yourself where that darkness was. A witch will always follow you. It will follow you and put its sickness in you. Someday you will have to stop. And so, you know, he's this guy. He gets out of prison after killing his cousin, which came after his town was condemned because it was a lead mining town, and that lead got in the water, and so everyone had to evacuate, which led to the death of his grandmother. So he's had this darkness put upon him since childhood. And now that he's out of prison, the darkness keeps following him and keeps following him. And now here's this personification of that evil in this guy, Bill. And like, now it's staring at him in the face in these like violent, sadistic acts. And as terrible as that is, it gives Miko the opportunity to, you know, kill that darkness.
And do you feel that he does?
I think we have to get into spoiler territory now, but yeah, I think he does. Because he takes this one guy, Alan, who's very troubled, who him and his friend Bunny find, and is sort of like in the ins and outs of addiction, and is newly unhoused, it seems like. And they sort of like go off and like start a new camp, mm-hmm. near Miko's original hometown. And so the hope is that they can start a new community where this former community once died. And so it's not exactly a happy ending for sure, but I think it's one with a path to hope, at least.
Yeah. And I want sometimes I'm like, in watching this movie, I'm like, how much of this is real? How much of this is happening? Is the culmination of the film completely rooted in realism? I do think it is, but and then it also has like a Western sort of thing, like a man comes into town, has business to do, meets new characters, takes on characters, and is met with a nemesis with very similar traits in some ways, but then is totally different in others, and then has to do what is right. And then has to figure out what to do afterwards, right? Mm-hmm. And I thought the acting in the movie just was outstanding. And again, understated, which I love, you know?
Yeah, a lot of... like non-actors in this movie. Miko isn't exactly an expressive guy, but you know, he's been in prison for 19 years where it's disadvantageous to be openly emotional. So he's very, very reserved. And the film asks you to read into his face and read into what he was saying. And it's interesting to me, just like observing the way the two actors work. Whereas, you know, like Bill is very showy, and is very eager to demonstrate his masculinity and his power. And Mika is not, but both guys have like very low body fat, and very pronounced cheekbones. So their faces are, so their like skin is just very tight on their faces. So like every move they make in their facial structure, just like really shows on camera, and they're both very magnetic on screen. And the dynamic of such like an independent, like handheld shot movie with these two guys who just immediately draw your eye is very engaging, especially with a movie like with a budget as small as this one.
Yeah, I just think it's an absolutely worthwhile, I think, to just, you know, invest in directors and voices that are different from yours and see what you might learn. And do you have any closing thoughts?
I mean, you know, one thing that I've been thinking about is also because I'm me and a big dork, like there is this real burgeoning subgenre of Native American black metal. Probably the most prominent one is Black Braid, whose album last year was just called Two, because it's their second record, was incredible, one of my favorites of the year. But another one is Pan American Native Front, who are like extremely confrontational and very open with their like enraged politics, but they're great. And another one is Natrachwin, who are much more spiritually focused and much more intent on singing about the beauty of nature, like if you know black metal, like Agaloc would. And so, you know, just because it seems like, if I were to say Native American black metal, that's a pretty specific subgenre. But even within that very specific subgenre, there's a multitude of voices. And, you know, so we need more Native American filmmakers, Native American authors, Native American artists, so we can get that multitude of voices from this group that I think is certainly not homogeneous. As even these films show, from this one director. So it's in our best interests as Americans, as film fans, to, like you said, Scott, invest in those directors and those artists.
I couldn't agree more. And with that, I'll see you on the flip side.
Have a good one, Scott.
Thank you. You too.